Worldviews matter, unless, of course, you like an oligarchy. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you in the studio. How many weeks has it been? I don't know.
Well, we've been running a few series for the listeners because we've had a lot of things going on and it's been very busy. I hope that our listeners enjoyed our four-week series with Dr. Michael Kaufman. His research and his writing is phenomenal. And if you liked what you heard, you know, obviously you can order a copy of that audio. Actually, it's a video from his talk at Camp American on that subject. And you can just contact us at principledpolicy.com or at campamerican.com, and you can find that video. And you can order it for yourself.
Yeah, actually, it's on the podcast posting. You can it's a direct click right over there, and you can give a donation to Camp American, and they'll send you a copy of that video.
Oh, absolutely. And also, I believe if you go to our Amazon store on principledpolicy.com, you might be able to order a copy of Plundered.
You can get the book.
Yes,
definitely.
That's right. And I would strongly suggest for our folks, that's a great addition to your library. Because we really need to know what's being done around us, to us, by those who we put in power over us.
And he really weaved it together pretty well with that. It sounds like when you first look at all the things he's talking about, they look so disparate. It's sort of like, it looks like all the little pieces are out here. And he weaves it all together and shows how they're all part of a big fabric.
Yes, yeah. And he's very good at doing
that. He's very good at that, yeah.
And that's what we try to do here as well on Principles and Policies, is try to pull a bunch of disparate-looking pieces together and show you the big picture. Somebody asked me the other day, Charles, what I did for a living, and I had to tell them that I'm a puzzle solver. I can take the little puzzle piece. It's like the analogy of a puzzle. You get this 1,000 or more piece puzzle. You've got a picture on the box. You open the puzzle up, dump it out on the table. You don't have that picture. It's all little shapes and squiggles, and they're all cut differently, and you're not sure, but you pick each one of them up, and each one of them has an image on it.
Yeah.
But that image, you're not exactly sure where it might fit in the bigger picture. Well, that's what I do with my policy consulting, and what we do with the Institute for Principle Policy. We take those little pictures, those little images, and show you how they fit together to create the bigger picture, which is really the picture you need to see in order to be able to appreciate what's going on.
I love that analogy, because there's an apologist I listen to, Dr. James White, and who's heavily into textual criticism of biblical texts. Mm-hmm. He has debated guys like Bart Ehrman and people who are also textual critics, but are skeptics.
Yes.
I would take Ehrman out of the skeptic. Ehrman basically uses his credentials as a former Christian to try to get Christians to abandon their biblical faith. And essentially, he thought that debating with Dr. White was going to be a cakewalk, and he found out he had a guy who was at least his equivalent.
If not his better in
biblical texts. What Dr. White always says is that doing some of these textual criticisms is like putting together a 10,000-piece puzzle without the picture on the box, and there are 10,100 pieces in the box. In other words, these extra pieces, you got to figure out which ones aren't the right ones without the picture.
You know, I like that, and I think I'll probably steal that from him. But, you know, folks, that's what we try to do here. We try to help you see what the picture really is. And that's the reason why we like people like Dr. Mike Kaufman, because he's done a lot of the work putting the puzzle pieces together.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is, too, Chuck, is a big part of the puzzle and actually seeing the actual picture, it's all in the lens you view it through as well. Because if you view it through certain lenses, well, then it looks perfectly fine, no matter if the sky is down and below you, off to the side. If say it's a picture of an eagle, the eagle's flying upside down, it all looks fine to you because at least you got the puzzle put together.
Yeah.
Now, you had to cut some of the pieces to get them to fit, and you had to throw out some others. And some of them have an image on one side, and the other side is the some of them have the other side up. But that's okay, because what you did was you got done, and you now have, say, you finished your puzzle. No, you haven't, because you're looking at it through the wrong lens.
Right.
Now, the right lens, and the lens that we use here, and I use in my business, and we use in politics and in education and in every other endeavor of life, is the lens of God's Word, the Scriptures. Specifically, having a biblical worldview, because that's what the lens is. It's your worldview. It's how you perceive the world. What are the basic presuppositional beliefs that you hold to be absolutely true? And then how do you use those to focus in on what's going on around you and make sense of it?
Yeah, and you know, here's the part, and anybody who's familiar with our show has heard us say this before. Everybody has presuppositions.
Yes, they do.
Even though they'll say, well, you think this and this and this and this, and you need to come to a neutral perspective and drop all those pre-thoughts and come at it from a neutral position. That Greg Bahnsen was great at this. Dr. Greg Bahnsen, he would say, remember, when you get into a talk with people that want you to drop your presuppositions, they're not neutral, and you shouldn't be.
Right, because there is no such thing as
there
neutrality.
There is no such thing as neutrality.
Right. You know, I think in Revelation it says that when he's talking about churches, the Spirit says, I would that you would be either hot or cold, but since you're neither, you're lukewarm, I will spew you out of my mouth. In other words, if you want to try to be neutral, you're not doing the job. Either be hot or be cold. Either have a biblical worldview or admit you have a pagan worldview. You can't have a non-worldview. That's, like I said, there is no such thing as an atheist, because A means the lack of, and theism means God, and that's lack of God, but there is no such thing as lack of God. Yeah. These people are anti-theists. They are against God. They know he exists. That some of them will even be intellectually honest enough to admit that he exists. It's just that they have no place for him in their worldview.
And again, another, we're going to name drop again. If you've ever seen any of Doug Wilson's Collision, the movie Collision.
Right, which was his debates between him and atheist Christopher Hitchens.
Christopher Hitchens, there is one point, at one point, Hitchens thinks he's made a great point, and Doug Wilson says, well, here is the attitude of the atheist, there is no God, and I hate him.
Exactly.
And so, in other words, that's exactly what Wilson was saying. He was saying, they know he's there, they claim he's not, and they hate him.
And they hate the fact that their first presupposition is negated by the truth.
Yes, exactly.
But that's, again, ladies and gentlemen, and we hope that when we do things like we run these specials from talks at camp from various speakers, that you don't just tune it out because it isn't me and Chuck talking, that you listen carefully to these folks because, well, number one, when we pick speakers for camp, one of the key reasons we pick them is because of their worldview. Because they have a biblically informed worldview, and they utilize it to look at their environment around them, whether they be involved in politics, the environment, education, business and industry, economics, you name it. That's the reason why they teach at Camp American, is because they have a biblically faithful worldview. Now, again, these are a lot of resources that you can get when you go over to campamerican.com or at Institute for Principal Policy at principalpolicy.com. And we would hope that you would take advantage of that, whether you download the podcast that we have and our archives, which are available online on our website, and you can listen to speakers such as Dr. Kaufman or Dr. Joel McDermott or Dr. Sasha Volacord or interviews with Dr. Mark Hamilton, who's a professor of philosophy, or any of the numerous other folks, or our special we ran here just this last week with Mark Stevenson, who's the director of Ohioans for Educational Freedom. Folks, these folks are putting their worldviews on the line.
Right. They're putting them on display also for you to see. And that can be a dangerous thing because there are a lot of people. We were just looking at something online, which we won't go into, but Barry and I were talking about someone who has been involved in Camp American, and we've run some of his stuff, Larry Pratt. And someone basically came on and chastised another person who's been at camp on their blog site for saying something about Larry Pratt and said, "Don't you know what that extremist nutcase blah 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 has said?" And I always say I love to come back and I comment on those things all the time. Those of you who know me, and I'll say something like, "Okay, be specific," because Larry's not quiet at all about his worldview.
No.
He is a Christian. He comes at his views on gun ownership and the right of self-defense and all that things from a biblical perspective.
Yes.
And also his politics from a biblical perspective.
Yes, he does.
Despite the fact that he is a Presbyterian, just like Barry and I are, he and Barry are in the same denomination, the PCA, and mm-hmm. there are, and I'm in the OPC, and there are elements in there in both of our denominations who would have us walk away from politics based on what they claim is a biblical worldview, except their biblical worldview isn't, at the end, particularly biblical. It's more humanistic.
Yes.
And that's why those things are out on display. So you can judge if you've developed your own Christian worldview and have done your best to weed out all the humanistic elements. Good luck, by the way. It's very difficult to get it all out. You have to be self-conscious about it, and I don't think I have all mine out. It pops up every once in a while, and I go, "Oh!"
Well, you remember, Charles, sanctification is an ongoing,
yes,
lifetime process.
Yeah, exactly.
It isn't a once-and-done kind of thing.
Yes.
And that's a difference in theological perspectives between,
exactly,
our particular theological viewpoint and some other theological viewpoints. So, you know, you have to keep that in perspective as well. But, you know, it's interesting you brought up this idea, because worldviews do matter.
Yeah.
Because if your worldview is not calibrated correctly, in other words, it's not in line with biblical truth, your ship can get awfully off course awfully fast. And I take, for example, because we have a couple of examples here.
Yes,
just now, that have happened in this last week, Charles. While we were running Dr. Kaufman, and we made a conscious decision to run four straight weeks and then run Mark Stevenson because of the hearings that are happening on Common Core this
week.
Maybe
we should tell people, because I didn't post exactly why we ran that program.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, we did that because we wanted people to get a refresher about the issue of Common Core, because on Tuesday of the week, that would be Tuesday the 14th at 6 p.m., there was a hearing, and I'm saying this in the past tense, even though it's still to happen because we're recording this on a Monday. There was a hearing, another hearing on House Bill 597, which is a bill to replace the Common Core structure that the legislature adopted and accepted when they accepted money from the federal government, called Race to the Top. And now we're starting to see all of the horror stories around the Common Core standards and the curriculum and the testing that's coming out with them. And Ohio, we're hoping Ohio will join a number of other states who have already done the smart thing, and they have totally repealed and dropped out of the Common Core initiative.
Yeah, we're not talking about, we don't want them to do what Indiana did, which was to pretend to drop out, but simply rename it, basically opt back in under,
yes,
a different name. And don't, listen, folks, Mike Pence really thinks he's going to be able to run for president on the basis of what he did for education in Indiana. He should be told in no uncertain terms that we don't like what you did, quote unquote, for education in Indiana. And that is hoodwink, or attempt, not too successfully, by the way, attempt to hoodwink the voters of Indiana that you've actually done something to get rid of Common Core.
Well,
when you haven't.
You know, Chuck, when I always say that in every circumstance, there's always danger and opportunity.
Yes.
Now, Common Core, we've seen the dangers to our children and to our educational fabric. But the opportunity is, we are now, it's helping to flesh out and flush out some pretenders, let's say. The folks who want you to think they're conservative, they may even be biblically minded, and they want you to potentially vote them president. And Mike Pence is one of them, because,
yep,
his name's come up, and it's obvious that from being a former congressman to now governor of Indiana, he's on that track to try to run for the Republican nomination for president, possibly in 16, maybe in 20, depending on how it goes. Another person who's already done this once, and if you look at their track record as governor of their state on education, it's actually worse, is Mike Huckabee.
Oh gosh.
And you know, and I'm not afraid to name names. And if you get upset at me because I'm attacking Mike Huckabee, I'm not attacking him. I'm just saying, if you look at his record, he was not a friend to a biblical worldview when it came to education.
It's okay. Today's topic, really, that we're is going to go into some things a little later. Isn't it interesting now, though, that suddenly Mike Huckabee, who, by the way, around here is often referred to as Tax Hike Mike, if you know anything about Mike Huckabee's record in Arkansas, it's pretty dismal.
Yes.
On taxes
and on education
And I don't mean about funding education. I mean about what was allowed into the curriculum.
Education policy. And again, that's where the opportunity comes in, because we now have so many people who were sitting on the sidelines before Common Core when it came to their own children or their grandchildren's education, who are now in red alert status.
Yeah.
And who are, as the old line from Network, which I'll paraphrase, I'm mad as everything and I'm not going to take it anymore.
That's right. Mad as blank and I'm not going to take it anymore. Yeah, those of you in your 50s know exactly what we're talking
about.
But
those people and others are the ones that we have to say, use your biblical worldview to look at these candidates as they come parading before you, asking for your vote, claiming to be everything for you. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the program, because we have an article that we want to talk about how the Republicans are running toward the religious liberty issue.
Yeah, suddenly.
Suddenly, all of a sudden. So, yeah. But what I really want to talk about today, and so listen to that. You go back to our archive, listen to last week's program with Mark Stevenson, because I think it's very eye-opening on Common Core and on education policy in general. You're also going to be voting on state board of education members, probably in your district. And so his organization, Ohioans for Educational Freedom, do a great job. They've endorsed really good candidates who support homeschooling, who are opposed to Common Core. So if you want to figure out what candidate to vote for State Board of Education, go to OEF's, it's OhioansForFreedom.com, and look it up. But the worldview issue we're talking about now is people who believed that certain Supreme Court nominees were going to be 100% true to the mark for them in perpetuity. And we know a number of our good friends in the social conservative movement who bought this sales pitch, hook, line, and sinker, when it was put forth during the Bush administration. And now we're starting to understand the fruit. And if you didn't understand it here about a year and a half ago, you were asleep too.
Yeah.
But now you're maybe really starting to understand the fruit of what they sowed. By being so non-biblically discerning in relation to these particular nominees. Because, you know, nominees have backgrounds, they have records, and they have public statements. And it isn't the U.S. Senate who are the only ones who get a look at this. The public should not just let their senators choose them on their own. They should weigh in on it. Now, a lot of people did weigh in, probably, sadly, because... Oh, it was a nominee that George Bush appointed, and he says he's a good believer, and so he's going to judge right down the line. Except he was, when you started getting the nominee questions, all of a sudden he was all for the doctrine of stare decisis, and he really didn't say he was a strict constructionist. And matter of fact, he avoided that question, I think, like the plague, if I remember correctly.
There's part of a reason for that, because if you go in and say, stare decisis, if you explain the subtleties of stare decisis, now it's supposed to work, and say that you are for natural law, then you won't be confirmed in the United States.
So you have to play a game, but sometimes the game gets played as a double blind.
And the one person where that rule did not hold was Clarence Thomas. And frankly, in this quote-unquote racist country, what it took was lots of white people calling in and saying, we don't like what you're doing to that man who's been appointed to the Supreme Court, and you better stop it.
Right, and that was mainly the Democrats who were doing that.
Yes, exactly.
Which is another – we can get into that a little bit later, because that's an interesting juxtaposition too.
Yeah, right.
But what we have is last week, Chuck, while we were running our specials – the United States Supreme Court made a couple of decisions. Well, most people call them non-decisions, but silence is still a decision.
Yes.
And the first one they made hit fairly close to home here for folks in Central Ohio and should across the state and for folks who are believers and have a biblical worldview. Because the United States Supreme Court, in an unsigned order, see, none of them wanted to take credit for this, interesting, refused an appeal from the Ohio State Supreme Court on First Amendment grounds of the firing of Mount Vernon science teacher John Freshwater. Now, I'm sure most of our listeners, I mean, we've talked about this before on the program, yeah. And I'm sure they've heard about this over the last 3.5 years, the case of John Freshwater, who was a middle school science teacher at Mount Vernon schools, and who was basically fired from his job, suspended, and then let go because of his beliefs. And, of course, there were a number of things that were brought forward, you know, that, oh, he burnt a kid's arm with a, you know, with a device to burn a cross into his arm, which that one went away fairly quickly when it was found that they really couldn't make that one
they
stick.
They settled on it, but
the school district settled.
Freshwater wanted to fight it, and the school district settled, and it looked basically like,
well, that's because
they were going to win that case hands down.
Their insurance attorneys didn't want to.
It was more expensive to fight it out than to pay off.
So. But the point is, and the real reason he was let go was because he kept a Bible on his desk, Charles, and he had some posters in his classroom which had some religious phrasing on them. Now, funny thing is, as we look at the articles from last week of this non-decision by the, well, what the Supreme Court decided was they denied certiorari, yeah. Which means they denied sealing it to bring it before the high court to hear the merits of the case and to decide whether or not the state Supreme Court erred or not in their decision. Now, the state Supreme Court's decision was a 4-3 ruling. It was a split. And basically said that he was insubordinate and therefore could be fired. It didn't matter what his First Amendment rights were. and honestly, that they wouldn't even allow that to be a defense because he was insubordinate. Why was he insubordinate? Because he had two books from the school library that he wanted to keep on his desk and a poster of George W. Bush in the classroom.
And see, therein lies the rub. The majority in the decision admitted that they were violating, that the school district was violating his First Amendment right.
Right.
Every other teacher can have, I can remember seeing pictures of people, absolutely reprehensible persons, in my classrooms.
I think they're okay with Che Guevara t-shirts in the classroom, but not George Bush or not God.
Yeah. No God, no George Bush, but Stalin. There are places where you can go and see Karl Marx on the wall.
Mao
Zedong.
Yeah. And we're talking about public school classrooms.
Yes,
folks,
we are.
Because it's okay to have those images on there because those people were great heroes of the revolutions.
Well, it's not even that. School districts will not force those people to take those down because of
First Amendment.
Their
freedom
of speech
rights, yeah. Which don't apply to Christians, I guess.
And they don't. We are rapidly going into a two-tier society.
Right. Now, a lot of people talk about a post-Christian environment, but that's not true.
No.
I rail against that phrasing every time I hear it, especially from Christian authors and talkers. They talk about us and we're in a post-Christian world. No, we're not. We're in God's world. He's still in control. He's still sovereign. He's just allowing us to feel the consequences of our rebellion against him.
Well, I know this is not what we want to get into, but there's a lot of eschatological baggage.
Oh, yes.
In that phraseology. There are a couple of different eschatological, and for those of you it's a big word, I understand. I didn't know what it was either 10 years ago. It means how you view the end times. How you view the end times has a tremendous effect on what you do during the present times. And it also can have an incredible view on how you view past times. A lot of people can't seem to get a handle, for instance, on the Puritans until they suddenly discover that the Puritans were post-millennial. And once they find out the Puritans were post-millennial and all that entails, all that particular worldview entails, because postmillennialism is a worldview.
Yes, it is.
Suddenly, it becomes clear what they were here for. They weren't here to rape, rob, pillage, and burn. They were here to build a new Christian society. And they were here to do it in a biblical manner. They didn't think that, well, oh, woe is us. It's all over with. Jesus is going to come a week from Tuesday. And they didn't think that the world was going to get worse and worse and worse and worse, and that the church would shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink until Jesus finally said he'd had enough and decided to come back. That's not the viewpoint. And you can see how that particular filter, as we talked about earlier, can have a profound effect on how you view the world and what you do in the world. So, that being said, the school districts understand this. Now, it's okay to kick around people right now. The current whipping boy is evangelical Christianity.
Has been for a little while, although it's interesting, though, because we should not make too much of that, because the trend line, actually, I was actually looking at some demographic research over the weekend, part of my other job I do for other clients, and the demographic trending research was actually in the last 20 years, the percentages of folks who have a negative view of evangelical Christians has actually declined by almost 50%. It was somewhere in the upper 40s, like in the 1990s, and that was kind of like right after the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition and the, you know, the March to Washington, all that other stuff happened where, well, honestly, people got a bad taste in their mouth about evangelicals because they were picking horrible candidates because it wasn't a consistent worldview that they were using.
Right. They were saying, well, he's close enough. He claims he's one of us. He's she.
And he's better than the guy with the D behind his name. Yeah.
And you know what? Sometimes he wasn't better than the guy with the D behind his name.
Sometimes he was worse.
In many cases.
But anyhow, so the trend line is actually starting to show that there is a drop-off except among one demographic group, Chuck, and I would say probably more than one. The one specific demographic group was college faculty members who, when asked about their intolerance or their lack of favor toward certain religion groups, evangelical Christianity, almost 80% of them had a negative view. They had a better view of Muslims and other non-orthodox, non-traditional faiths than they had of evangelical Christians.
Sure.
But those are the people who are teaching the next generation of leaders.
They're the worldview shapers. That's the problem. This is the problem that I've had with public education, where Mr. Freshwater chose to make his living until, I don't know how many years
ago. About 3.5 years.
Yeah. The fact is that his particular worldview is closed out, but everyone else's is allowed in. Not only allowed in, but encouraged on the basis that, well, evangelical Christianity is how these kids are already thinking, and therefore we need to expose them, quote unquote.
We need to broaden their horizons.
We need to broaden their horizons. In fact, what they're really doing is squeezing out. Remember, that idea of presenting a broadening horizons and presenting other viewpoints is a quote unquote neutralist position. Remember, they're not neutral, and you shouldn't be.
And you shouldn't be. You shouldn't accept neutrality.
That's right. There is no neutrality. But that is the attempt. Well, we're neutral parties. It's sort of like the news media.
Right.
Do you remember when we're going in the Wayback Machine here for a minute. Remember when Ross Perot ran for president in 1992? What did Ross Perot do? He couldn't get any traction in the media. And he had, you know, a gazillion dollars. So he went out and he sort of made his own media.
Yes, he did.
He created his own media. And I can still remember guys on some of these NPR talking head shows and all kinds of different commentary coming out and said, literally, you're bypassing the filters.
Yep.
A filter. Okay, a journalist, and these were journalists, people who called themselves journalists, in other words, opinion makers. Their job is not to be a filter. Just the opposite. Their job is to find the facts and present them. Now, they can present them from either a position of attempted neutrality, and everybody should understand that, or they can present them as an opinion piece. What these guys were saying was, well, our opinion was that what you were saying wasn't worth anything, and therefore we were shutting you out of the debate. Now, what was really happening there? What were they really trying to do? They were trying to keep him from getting votes from one side or another. What Sure. side were they trying to keep him to get from getting votes on, considering the political proclivities of most of mainstream journalism?
Well,
Bill Clinton.
Obviously.
They thought that Perot would have stolen votes from Bill Clinton.
Of course.
And in fact, considering his social policies, they should have been right. However, is that the way it worked out?
No, the way it worked out is he stole votes from libertarian-leaning Republicans.
Yeah. Because he was talking a left libertarian message. And the libertarians and the Republican Party were smart enough to understand libertarianism when they saw it.
Yes, indeed.
So, they abandoned George Bush, who was nothing like a libertarian. George Bush 43. They abandoned him in droves, and voila, we got Bill Clinton, and we got him twice. And then Ross Perot, I don't know, got hauled off to an insane asylum someplace or something.
Oh, I don't know. He's still making billions somewhere. That's okay.
Yeah.
But the point is that the beat goes on at the Supreme Court. Because also, Chuck, you know, looking at freshwater, and again, this is one of those situations where what the court did by not acting was to basically affirm the ruling of the Ohio Supreme Court, which basically said your beliefs don't matter.
Yeah.
And you can be fired at will because as a Christian, and specifically an evangelical Christian, although they didn't say this specifically in their decision, you don't have First Amendment rights. That's really
essentially
what
they did
was,
yeah, if you get down to the brass tacks, you don't have a First Amendment right.
Now we're going to talk about other First Amendment rights you don't have that the Supreme Court has decided by not deciding. This is the other big case that came out that same day, Charles. Most people missed the freshwater, unless you were local here. You missed the freshwater ruling because you were too busy hearing about this ruling, which was that the Supreme Court refused to grant certiorari to a group of cases coming out of about two circuits regarding gay marriage. Now, basically, these were appeals of rulings overturning marriage amendments in a number of states. And so the court, by refusing to hear it, basically sent a signal that, for the very least, they're okay for the time being with at least five more states having same-sex marriage forced upon them, even though in most of those states, their voters have said, we believe marriage is between a man and a woman, traditional biblical viewpoint of marriage.
And not by small margins.
And not by small margins.
Overwhelmingly.
Either. Those states that the appeal involved directly were the state of Virginia, Oklahoma, Utah, Wisconsin, and Indiana. Now, I know at least four of those five states have had a marriage amendment on their books.
Yeah.
Now, what happens is because that ruling applies to the entire circuit, or that lack of ruling, I should say, denying cert is a ruling without ruling. That actually also enveloped the states of North Carolina, West Virginia, South Carolina, Wyoming, Kansas, and Colorado. So in other words, 11 states were affected by this particular non-ruling by our United States Supreme Court led by Chief Justice John Roberts. Now, there are some out there who believe And we'll find out fairly soon whether they're right or not, because I think next month they'll make the decision on whether to grant cert on this case. That there's cases coming out of this circuit, the Sixth Circuit, from Kentucky, challenging the constitutionality of their traditional marriage law, and that the courts were not, they were holding off in those circuits in order to get a better case in front of them. Now, that's what optimistic social conservatives are believing. And the question is, are they right? And if they are right, are they able to count to five?
Okay, here's why they're wrong. Because all this nonsense, all these rulings and overturning of state law are a couple of different things. A, it's predicated on the fact that the majority of the Supreme Court has already ruled that a perfectly legal and constitutional Article 4 law at the federal level was unconstitutional.
Right.
In other words, what they basically ruled was that Article 4 was unconstitutional.
You know, when you put it that way, you're absolutely right.
I mean,
that's the absurdity of
that's the absurdity. Basically, what Article 4 does is allow Congress to set what's known as there is a clause in the Article 4 of the Constitution known as the Full Faith and Credit Clause. What it allows is the federal government through Congress, not through the courts, through Congress, to set the effect of state laws. In other words, if Ohio were to pass a law that said one thing or another, what effect that would have on the other 50 states?
49 states.
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry, 56 states, right? If you're listening to a Barack Obama's account of 57 and a Raquel Welch's count of 52. So
they just want Cuba and the People's Republic of China to be
right into the Union. Yeah. So, okay, 49 states. Essentially, it allows Congress to set the effect of that law. In other words, that law can, according to Congress, Congress can say, well, okay, you can have that law because it's your local custom.
Right.
But you cannot, you know, if somebody from Massachusetts comes into Ohio, does something under this law and wants to take it home, and then says, well, I got to do this in Ohio, so therefore I'm filing suit to force you to allow this to have the same effect, Congress can say, nope, not so fast. That's an Ohio custom. It's not necessarily a Massachusetts custom. You can't force it on them this way. We're not stepping in to allow that.
And how the legal and the political term is used, it's called the strong public policy.
Yes, strong public policy.
Now, by that they mean it can't just be an afterthought or custom. It really has to be spelled out in no uncertain detail. We believe this is the standard for this state, and that's what we've put into our laws or, hey, in Ohio and in other states, our Constitution.
Now, because of the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, which effectively say, not effectively, directly say, that unless it's part of the enumerated powers granted to Congress in Article 1, Section 8 and 9, then those powers belong directly to the states, and they may set what goes on in their state themselves, as long as it does not violate, for instance, the guarantee of a Republican government in all 50 states. Some other clause that would be very difficult, Barry. If John Kasich were to declare himself a dictator, actual de facto, not. Sure.
Okay.
But you know what I'm saying.
I'm just grimacing behind the mic here because you've just taken away another question I can ask our class.
Well, they're not. They won't necessarily hear it in time. So well, what I'm saying basically is that what has happened is the Supreme Court has swooped in and said that clause in the Constitution that says that the Congress may set that restriction, they essentially said it's unconstitutional for them to do that.
So the Constitution is unconstitutional at this point.
Yeah. Seriously, that is how absurd and how poorly thought out that decision on what's called the Defense of Marriage Act was.
Right.
Because that's exactly what the Defense of Marriage Act did. If you ever read it, it's extremely short.
Yes.
It's like about, what, four paragraphs, I think.
The one in Ohio is two paragraphs.
Well, I'm talking about the federal.
Federal was about three or four, yes.
Yeah. It's very short, very to the point. It basically says that laws, marriage laws in one state will have no effect on another state with a strong public policy.
Right.
And the fact is, Ohio had a strong public policy. Kentucky had a strong public policy. All these states had strong public policies. And the fact is, there's nowhere in the enumerated powers any place that could be construed as giving any power over marriage or, in fact, any family activity to the federal government. So when the Supreme Court did this, which is causing all this havoc now with, you know, deciding gay marriage is, can actually exist, which it can't, because we've talked about that in the past as well. This would all be unnecessary had they simply done what they should have done, and that was said, well, there's you can't challenge the Defense of Marriage Act. Because it's perfectly constitutionally legal to do what it says they can do in the Constitution. So here we sit. Now, what's happened? Well, we've had people who believe that the Constitution says what the Supreme Court says, not what the words say. And voila, that is their worldview. They believe that the state is God walking on earth. And whatever the documents say is whatever the Supreme Court says they say. I'm trying to remember the Supreme Court justice. Was it Charles Evans Hughes? Or no, it was way back at the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th, who said the Constitution says what we say it says.
Constitution says what the judges say it means. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think it was Charles Evans Hughes. I think you're right. But, you know, Chuck, that's the whole problem we have today is, we've put too much emphasis on the courts.
Way too much.
I'm just going to be frank about it. And this is the fruit that we have out of this. When we say that five people in black robes can determine whether or not the Constitution's constitutional or not, I think we've gone well beyond the boundaries, the checks and balances that our founders put into the document. And we have created a demigod status for a mix of five people sitting in black robes to say what our culture should be, how we should think, how we should act, how we worship or don't worship, who we can associate with or not associate with as we choose to be, whether personally or in our businesses. Charles, we have basically five people, and it can vary because the nine-headed monster can show any five heads at any time.
Right,
who have basically set themselves up to be the gods of this culture. And we have accepted it because we've put too much emphasis on the courts. How have we put too much emphasis on the courts? Because we worry too much about who's going to be president of the United States.
Bingo.
And we don't pay a bit of attention to who our congressmen are, or who our local elected officials are who are coming up through those ranks. We just go and vote for names and, you know, oh, I saw their commercial or I got their mailer and yep. I like this person and they're telling me all the right stuff. And we just vote. And that's really, honestly, you know, the old saying is that apathy wins most elections. It's been true.
Yes.
But the point is we're called to a higher standard. We are called to study to show ourselves approved. Now, people will argue, well, that's just talking about Scripture. No, it's talking about life. It's talking about taking all of life captive to the Word and the obedience of God. We are called to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Every thought. Chuck, if we have to take every thought captive, now, wouldn't that mean that when we think about our work, our families, our businesses, our education, our leisure, our politics, our laws, that they're supposed to be captive to the obedience of Christ. What is that obedience of Christ? Matthew 28:20. go, you know, the Great Commission in 18, and all authority has been given me in heaven and in earth. So go ye therefore and disciple the nations, baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things I commanded you. That's Christ speaking. Those are red letters in your red letter Bibles.
Yep.
Observe doesn't mean to sit back and look at it and go, well, I kind of like that, and I'm not sure how that fits here. I can ignore that one for a while. Observe means to actually do it. You know, like a servant would observe when his master says, wash the car. The master comes out an hour later and the car is sitting there with mud all over it. Has the servant observed the command of the master? No, he hasn't.
No.
When Christ said, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, he means to follow it. Now, Chuck, did he say, he said, make disciples of what? Of all nations. Sounds to me like there's a political edge in that, too.
Sure does.
Kind of a little strange here, folks, if you think about it. Why would Christ be talking about politics? Didn't he eschew politics? Didn't he, when he was in front of Pilate, when Pilate said, are you the king of the Jews? He said, that's what you say. But my kingdom's of another world. No, he just said he got his authority from a different place. He didn't say that his kingdom was not in this world at all. It's that his kingdom, i.e., the fact that his authority is coming from another place, which is coming from God.
Gary DeMar from American Vision has written an entire book on the subject of what does that of mean?
Yeah, what does that of mean?
Yeah, and the of we're speaking of, my kingdom is not of this world. Of in that situation can mean two things. It can mean my kingdom is not here.
Physically residing in this world.
Or it can mean it's not made of the same stuff.
Exactly.
Well, it's how you, again, worldview issue.
It's how you use the Greek, too.
Yeah, and exactly. And basically, people who do the Greek exegesis say, it didn't mean not here.
It didn't mean not physically present. It's made of. That's right.
Yeah. And the fact is that Christ's kingdom isn't made of the same stuff. That manly kingdoms are made of. No.
But when Christ calls us to take every thought captive.
Exactly.
To his obedience is to those commands. Those commands are his kingdom. That kingdom comes from God, which means those commands come from God. Oh, where do we find God's commands in the Bible? Well, throughout it, but where specifically? Oh, can we think about Exodus 20, maybe? There's 10 of them. you know, we got to think about this. Now, folks, I can hear people right now getting all frustrated.
Yeah.
Oh, they're legalists. They're not. No, we're not. You show me and exegete it correctly in Scripture where God has said that his rules don't apply anymore. Because it's not in there.
And Paul didn't say so either.
And Paul didn't say so either.
And Peter didn't say so either.
And the author to the Hebrews didn't say so either.
No.
Let's keep going down the list. Paul, Peter, James, Jude, you name the epistle and the writer.
Let me give you the most con. Well, do you cut your sideburns and...
no, mine are nice and furry here.
And... I could ask you all these, but you have all this stuff. Yes. Do you have a beard? Yes, you do.
Yes, I do.
No, but you've let a razor touch yours.
Not for a while.
But it's not to the floor. So
that's it.
Yeah. No, you know what I'm saying.
But
what
I'm not,
they'll say
the ceremonial
is these
laws,
old ceremonial laws and the old sacrificial laws, folks. Those
were specifically abrogated because even Christ said
abrogated, and the dietary laws were abrogated in the Book of Acts.
Yes, although that doesn't mean that they're not valuable for you to this day.
That's true. But I love shellfish. So.
Oh, that's okay. You and I can disagree on that.
I'll break the ice. I'm a theonomist, but I like shellfish.
That's okay. I am too, but I like sushi, and you and I don't see
eye
on that.
No
either.
Sushi. I've met no one ever who was a food sterilization specialist like I was, who would eat sushi. And
y'all,
I'll
y'all
stand
don't know
by
how
that.
To live. Y'all They're, don't have.
Oh yes, we do. We don't like parasites.
Well, anyhow, let's get back around to this. So basically, the Supreme Court last Monday also said for these 11 states, you must allow gay marriage. So Chuck, what happened is, the Supreme Court has now abrogated the Article 4 of the Constitution and basically said these 11 states, by fiat, do not have a right to have a Republican form of government, meaning that they have local officials and state officials who are making their laws,
right,
and people who can go with, you know, with a plebiscite to write their, help write what is in their constitutions.
Bingo, because what is the core of Republican government? It's representation.
It's representative
so
government.
So what has basically happened is that the Supreme Court in, now, you say 11 states, and I think that's what that story says.
Right.
I've heard it up to 35 states.
Well, they're talking about the extent of states who either already are, yeah, have some form, such as civil unions or you know,
right,
faux marriage light, you know, is what I like,
yeah,
to call it.
Exactly, faux marriage light. But that being said, what they've said is that the Supreme Court will be their representatives in this matter.
Yes.
And you have no say. They're unelected representatives.
Wait a minute. When you have five people who are making all the rules for you and your culture, that puts you into an oligarchy,
doesn't
it? That's
called an oligarchy, although, the strictly speaking, you need eight people.
Okay, well, you got nine. Five of them have to agree.
But nobody uses that. That's literal Greek. That's Greek literalism. Yes. We don't go there. Yeah, it's ruled by a committee.
Yes.
It's ruled by an unelected committee.
Gee, the U.S. Supreme Court is appointed.
Well, in Russia, they had another name for that. It was called a Soviet.
A Soviet, that's right.
And folks, that's exactly what a Soviet is. It's an unelected committee that makes policy decisions.
Guess what the Supreme Court is turning out to be.
It's an unelected committee.
And they're making the decisions without deciding. All they had to do was just decide not to hear this case.
Well, what they had to do, they had to have a compliant, if you will, or a they had to have an underlayer. So basically what's happening is a federal judge is rapidly gaining the power to abrogate entire sections of the United States Constitution, let alone state constitutions. That was never supposed to be allowed to happen. Basically, before John Marshall's court in the 1830s, I think, state law was not available for review in a federal court at all, period. And John Marshall simply usurped the power, just like he usurped the power of judicial review. And why do we say that? Ladies and gentlemen, you need to take our Institute on the Constitution course.
Absolutely.
Or someone in your area. I know there's some forming in the Canal Winchester area, because we were just there with the person who's going to be teaching them.
Yes.
But all over the state, for those podcast listeners, if you're in the Central Ohio area or the Southeastern Ohio area, we're going to teach you why. And we're not going to leave you in suspense and make you take the class to find out why. The reason is because it ain't in the Constitution. Period. The courts did not have judicial review. So much for three co-equal branches. There is no such thing as three co-equal branches. One branch had hegemony over the other two. And one sub... Okay, and that the Congress,
uh-huh,
in the Constitution holds all the power. The president really doesn't do anything except enforce the law that Congress... Now, he can veto the law, and he can refuse to enforce it.
Yes, he can.
And what happens when the president refuses to enforce a law? It's supposed to ignite a constitutional crisis in which a great deal happens with Congress either goes back and reexamines the law, or they impeach the president.
Right.
So what's happened when presidents in the recent past have refused to enforce laws?
Meh.
Nothing. Gosh, there's nothing we can do about this. He's got all this power. No. And we're not talking necessarily about just recently with the John Boehner saying, well, there's not really anything we can do. Yeah, there is. This happened under the Clinton presidency when Clinton came out and announced he wasn't going to enforce directly. He said, I'm not going to enforce a law that required that political contributions collected by force from labor unions had to be returned.
Right.
He said, no, I'm not going to enforce that law. Okay, well, what should that have done immediately? He should have been impeached.
Right.
Or Congress should have looked at it and said, well, it's unconstitutional, or impeached him, period. Exactly. Those are the two powers. Okay.
Those are your constitutional.
Those are your constitutional. Now the courts.
Okay.
Are under that.
Yes, they are. And now the problem is that because that fiction exists.
Yes.
This is what you get. Now, this is from the end of the article that we've been looking at on this issue with the U.S. Supreme Court declining to intervene in gay marriage from the Reuters agency. At the very end of that article, there's a paragraph. It's kind of a throwaway paragraph to them, but to me, it's the heart of the whole problem. And it says, quote, state officials defending their bans, that is, bans on gay marriage, counter that the Constitution does not dictate how states should define marriage, and that there is no deeply rooted legal tradition that supports a right to gay marriage. Charles, you know this as well as I do. When you go into a fight and you give up your basic presupposition up front, how are you going to come out?
On the bottom.
You're going to come out a loser.
Yeah.
This is what state officials are doing. Because, okay, the Constitution doesn't dictate how states should define marriage. Do you want the Constitution to dictate
exactly.
how states define marriage?
Exactly.
I don't believe you want to do that because, first of all, number one, a constitutional amendment, you'd lose. To be quite honest with you, you'd lose it. But secondly, then what you're dealing with is what's called legal positivism
yes.
or positive law theory, where, oh, we can only have a right if it's specifically enumerated in the Constitution.
It's a messianic view of the state.
Yes, it is. Now, and then it goes even better because it's a high church messianic view of the state.
Absolutely.
Because he says there's no deeply rooted legal tradition that supports a right to gay marriage. Since when was legal tradition our standard for whether something's constitutional or not?
Well,
it has been ever since about 1896 with the advent of case law theory.
Right. And you know what else happened in the 1890s? The state of Utah was forced to change its state law
yes.
with a deeply rooted tradition in
polygamy.
Polygamy.
Yes.
In order to become
a state,
a member of the union.
That's right. So, if we're going to look at deeply rooted legal traditions, we might get ourselves in some deep trouble.
Okay. Using really deeply rooted legal tradition and a right in the same sentence is oxymoronic.
Yeah, because your rights come from
your
God.
Rights
they
come
don't
from
come
God.
From long legal traditions.
And there is no right to gay marriage.
Although we do talk about in the class about the heritage of English common law.
Sure.
But it's based upon biblical absolutes that were commonly known to men.
Yes.
Not in legal tradition where the courts define what the law, the Constitution is what we say it is.
Yeah, really, the English common law popped up. It grew. It's got a long, varied history. But really, Alfred the Great.
Yes, indeed.
And Alfred the Great was a very, very devout Christian.
Yes.
And wanted his kingdom's laws based on Biblical law, not on man-made tradition.
Right. Well, Chuck, and it's this kind of muddled thinking among those who are supposedly representing us that may be the reason why we're seeing these type of rulings happen, because they've given up the ground. And maybe it's the reason why in a recent Census Bureau report, according to Pew Research Analysis, marriage rates of Americans 18 and older hit a bottom of 50.3% in 2013. This is the lowest rate in 93 years of keeping these statistics. And that includes gay marriages, Chuck. Even with the advent of gay marriage, the marriage rates are falling.
Yeah.
Why? We've given up the sacredness of marriage.
Absolutely.
And we've decided it can be anything. It's a civil.
It's a wax
practice.
Nose. It's a wax nose.
It's
we
wax
can make
nose.
It into anything we want to.
And if it's just a civil tradition, well, then people don't have to follow those traditions if they don't want to. I'll create my own tradition. I'll create many traditions. And some people do that. But ladies and gentlemen, we're running out of time. We're really not going to have time to talk this week about how Republicans are rallying around religious liberty. So we're going to save that for next week. Join us, because that's an interesting little topic. And you're going to see with a lot of people who are parading for 2016 why you have to be careful about how you define terms.
Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.